The National Broadcasting Company presents an address by former President Harry S. Truman before the American Public Health Association, which is holding its 83rd annual convention in Kansas City. Mr. Truman will be introduced by New York State Health Commissioner Dr. Herman E. Hillebaugh, President of the American Public Health Association.
On the occasion of the 1955 Albert Lasker Awards, here in Kansas City, Missouri, at the 83rd annual meeting of the American Public Health Association, I have the privilege to introduce the former president, Mr. Harry S. Truman, who will speak on the subject, medical research and public health in the nation today. President Truman.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Dr. Hillebaugh, Ms. Lasker, and the distinguished guests and members of the American Health Association and fellow public health workers. It's a very great pleasure for me to have this opportunity to say a few words to you on public health and to inform you of my interest in it. I want to say to Dr. Link that I think his son is a young man of very good judgment. In the summer of 1951, I had the privilege of laying the cornerstone of the magnificent clinical center of the National Institutes of Health. At that time, I pledged the American people that I would keep on working to make the best medical care available to all of our citizens as long as I was president and as long as I had life in me. I'd like to talk to you tonight about ways to bring better health to all of our people, 165 million of them. 10 years ago, almost to this very day, on November the 19th, 1945, I sent a special message on health to the Congress of the United States. This message, I believe, was the first transmitted by a president dealing exclusively with the subject of health. I sent that message to the Congress because this great nation was doing so little to safeguard its most precious asset, the health and well-being of its citizens. The Selective Service System had just released figures which showed that approximately 5 million men between the ages of 18 and 37 had been examined and classified as unfit for military service during World War II. Furthermore, after actual induction, about 1.5 million of the men passed by selective service examinations were discharged from the Army and Navy for physical and mental disability, exclusive of wounds. There were 34% of the young men of this country that were unfit for military service. That's a disgrace to this great nation. Think about and contemplate that in this great free country of ours. Millions of our citizens were not able to achieve good health, and millions more did not have the means to combat the high cost of sickness. I proposed in the 1945 that the federal government should provide financial aid to construct hospitals, health centers, and rehabilitation facilities. I pointed out that states and communities should share the financial responsibility for this hospital construction with the federal government. In 1946, the Hill-Burton Hospital Construction Act was passed by the Congress, authorizing a maximum of $75 million a year in federal aid for this program. 4 years later, this authorization was raised to $150 million a year. It is most appropriate that this legislation should bear the name of the distinguished senior senator from Alabama, Lister Hill. He is the son of a doctor and is named for one of the world's greatest surgeons. Lister Hill has battled continuously for an expansion of the hospital construction program. During the past three congressional sessions, he has succeeded each time in persuading the Congress to increase appropriations for the Hill-Burton program above the inadequate sums proposed by the present administration. And this is not a political talk. Senator Burton, who with Lester Hill sponsored the bill, is now a justice of the Supreme Court. He's a Republican and a great public servant, and I'm glad that I appointed him to the highest court in the land. In the Senate, he was always a public health advocate. This hospital construction program brought about the addition of more than 100,000 hospital beds and more than 500 community health centers. Most of these hospital beds have been built in rural areas, and their availability has attracted scores of young physicians to practice in those areas. It is also gratifying to note that of the $2 billion which has gone into this program, more than two-thirds has been contributed by state, local, and private sources. In the true democratic fashion, the people have taken hold of this program and shaped it to meet their needs. But we must now accelerate our hospital construction, and we must accelerate it to meet the conditions with which we are faced. Our population is rapidly expanding, while many of our existing facilities are becoming obsolete. The nation is falling far behind in meeting the increased demands of our people for hospital and health service. The Hill-Burton program will come up for renewal in 1956, and I'm sure that Senator Hill and his colleagues will demand a substantial increase in the annual rate of construction. In that health message of 1945, I also urged a broadening of public health, maternal, and child health services. In that message, I said that no area in the nation should continue to be without the services of a full-time health officer and other essential personnel. No area should be without public health services and sanitary facilities. No area should be without community health services such as maternal and child health care. Both 79th and 81st Congresses increased the grants in aid programs for maternal, child health, and crippled children's services. Legislation providing for federal aid to local public health units passed the Senate on two separate occasions, but was blocked in the House of Representatives by the organized medical lobbyists. Now, take that for what it's worth. In the 1945 health message, and again in the 1947 and the 1949, I said to the Congress that the health of the American people was dangerously imperiled by a serious shortage of doctors and health personnel. Legislation to enable the medical schools to increase their enrollments was passed by the Senate twice, but met the same fate as the local health units bill in the House of Representatives, and for the same reason. The doctor shortage has actually become much worse since the end of World War II. The Health Resources Advisory Committee, which I appointed in 1950, and which is headed by a great Missourian, Dr. Howard A. Rusk, reported in February of this year that the net ratio of active physicians to population is now lower than it was before World War II. There's legislation now before the Congress providing for $250 million in federal aid over a five-year period for the construction and expansion of medical schools. The present administration has opposed the bill, and the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare testified at the time that she knew nothing about doctor shortages. Now think of that. She also said she knew nothing about the demand for polio vaccine. the American people will not for long tolerate a do-nothing attitude about a doctor shortage crisis which concerns the health and welfare of millions of American families. You know what I wish? I wish some of these people who do not know anything about doctor shortage could go into some of these counties where the nearest doctor is 40 miles away and maybe break a finger or a toe and then find out what it means not to be able to get to a doctor. I don't want them to break a leg or an arm or a neck. I'd just like them to learn something. But even more important than getting more hospitals and doctors is the matter of medical research. Medical research is the foundation of all medical progress. For each doctor can only apply as much knowledge as medical research can open up for him. As president, I did everything I could to encourage the legislation which created new institutions of mental health, heart, arthritis, and metabolic diseases, and neurological diseases, and blindness. These expanded efforts reflect the amazing transformation in the public health work in the field of research. Medical research is changing the face of medicine and public health, as you heard here tonight. I am informed by medical authorities that between 1944 and 1952, medical research saved more than 845,000 lives, added 5 full years to the average American's life expectancy, and reduced the death rate from all causes nearly 10%. Now, isn't research worthwhile? Of course it is. Armed with new weapons, beginning with antibiotic wonder drugs, the physicians and the public health officers have been able to bring curative and preventive medicine to communities all across the land. For example, with the advent of penicillin, deaths from rheumatic fever, have declined 70%. Influenza deaths have been reduced 63%. In addition to human survival and happiness, these advances have made possible billions of dollars in increased national productivity and additional revenue for the state and federal governments. In 1952 alone, the federal treasury profited by an estimated $234 million in income and excise tax receipts through the decline in the death rate since 1944. But this is far short of our goal. Millions of our people are still being deprived of adequate medical care and the full benefits of medical research. In the 1953 session of the Congress, the House Interstate Commerce Committee conducted months of hearings on the effect of disease upon the national economy. In its final report, the committee, summing up the evidence, said, and I quote the committee report, "During the course of our hearings, we received startling testimony that the annual cost to the nation from illness is roughly equivalent to the total income tax revenue, or $30 billion annually. But in contrast, our total national expenditure for medical research, federal, state, local, and private, including industry, is less than $200 million. A year. But a long way we have yet to go. Millions of Americans will continue to die long before their time because we have not yet found ways of dealing with cancer, mental illness, and heart disease, and other killers of man. These aggressors are a real menace and an immediate threat, and all of us must unite to overcome them. In this battle, there's no room for political or professional rivalries. In a war against disease, we cannot tolerate false economy. We cannot tolerate timidity. We cannot tolerate indifference. Medical scientists have testified before the Congress that increased funds for the construction of research laboratories and facilities are urgently needed in order to attract young and able men into research and to provide the space in which new discoveries can be made. During the 1955 congressional session, a bill to provide $90 million in matching laboratory construction grants over a three-year period passed the Senate unanimously. It will be up for consideration before the House in the coming January, and I am confident that the responsible congressional leadership of both parties will vote the needed funds, and we must do everything we can to encourage them and to stop that medical lobby from stopping it. But no matter what we do to develop medical research and provide for more hospitals and doctors, we must get to the basic need of universal health insurance. I tried as president, and I'm sorry I failed, to bring about prepaid health insurance within the reach of all Americans through expansion of our existing Social Security system with payroll deductions adjusted according to the amount of income. I made such a proposal because more than half the American people were being deprived of health insurance either because of financial inability to meet premium costs or the lack of availability of private health insurance. I renewed my health insurance proposals in 1947 and again in 1949. And in 1951, I made it clear that I was not advocating any particular plan, that all I wanted was any good, workable plan that would make it possible for all Americans to pay for the medical care they need. Get that? To pay for the medical care they need. Now, if that's socialized medicine, I'll stand corrected. I challenge those... I challenged those who were blocking health insurance and told them that if they would come up with a proposal that was better or one that even was almost as good, I would go along with them. They didn't come up with anything. The opponents of public health insurance came up with absolutely nothing. The job still has to be done. The basic need remains the same. Present health insurance covers only 15%. Of the more than $10 billion of medical bills of the American people. And 8 million American families are today in debt for medical care. Federal, state, and local governments have a joint and serious responsibility to meet this situation. We must plan and plan boldly for the creation of a system of medical care worthy of this great country of ours. We do not have the time to listen to the defeatists. We must work together to bring within the reach of all our people the great blessings which advance in medical science has made possible. What's the use making all these advances if the people for which they're made can't get to them and use them? I salute the pioneer health workers and research workers we honor here tonight with the Albert Lasker Awards. Tonight's awards cover many important fields of medicine. In the field of heart disease, you honor a University of Minnesota surgical team, which has made possible new and daring types of heart surgery. And you honor a University of Wisconsin biochemist, who has given us a new weapon against coronary thrombosis. I'm particularly happy to salute the award winner in the field of mental disease, the Menninger Foundation of Topeka, Kansas. We are very proud of our good Kansas neighbors, Drs. Carl and William Menninger. I commend them and all their colleagues who are bringing a new day of hope for the hundreds of thousands of mentally ill in this country. In the field of tuberculosis, you honor a team effort in the creation of a new and powerful drug against this dreaded killer. Typifying the breadth of the Lasker Awards, tonight you honor a Canadian doctor responsible for the large-scale production of a vaccine against poliomyelitis. Nothing could make me happier than the Lasker Award to the nursing services of the U.S. Public Health Service. I have a profound respect. I have a profound respect for this great health arm of our government. As the frontiers of public health have widened, its thousands of dedicated workers have risen to meet new responsibilities. All these people honored tonight and their distinguished predecessors should be an inspiration to all of us. As they reached out into the unknown and brought us new knowledge, there was undoubtedly many times when the obstacles seemed too great and the voices of the defeatists too loud. But they persevered and they climbed the mountain. New medical knowledge cannot reach or benefit the public promptly and fully without the dedicated, devoted work of you men and women in the public health field. Let's work together and march together to our goal of a happier and healthier United States of America.
The National Broadcasting Company has presented an address by former President Harry S. Truman before the American Public Health Association, which is holding its 83rd annual convention in Kansas City. Mr. Truman was introduced by New York State Health Commissioner Dr. Herman E. Hillebo, President of the American Public Health Association. This program originated through the facilities of WDAF Kansas City. This is the NBC Radio Network.